Okay, I thank David, Moses, and KITP for making this possible. It has been very educational. Talk today. The main idea is to.
Yes.
Is to re-examine the.
Green light is on.
Is it electricity on?
Is my brainwave on?
You have
to. So re-examine the vacancy mechanism for validity, and our proposal is that if you combine it with another type of defect, what we call excitons, which I'll explain during the course of my talk, then it's possible to get super solid even when vacancies by themselves were not. In helium, whether this is the mechanism of super solidity in helium, whether it really is super solidity in helium, we are trying to learn during this meeting and hopefully from this point on. Okay, my collaborator Fuchang Zhang, who is also here, and Dai Si from Hong Kong U. So some of the basic ideas of what we're going to talk about is already published in this paper here in Physical Ref B. Okay, so some years ago, people proposed an intriguing possibility for quantum crystal, which is that you can have this density periodic modulation, but at the same time that the atoms are mobile, and since they're mobile, they can both condense and then exhibit superfluidity, which makes it what we call super solid. So recently, and now three groups have observed this non-classical rotational invariance. It's controversial and debatable whether this is genuinely a bulk equilibrium property, but certainly it's interesting to try to address and ask whether it is possible for this to be a bulk equilibrium property, and that's our motivation. Okay, well, going back 20-odd years, Andreev and Lifshitz introduced this vacancy mechanism for supersolid. So the idea is that because this is a quantum crystal, the large quantum fluctuations can favor a finite density of vacancy even at t equals zero, which of course then can both condense. From a gestural wave function point of view, Chester also suggested this, since generally gestural wave functions have off-diagonal non-range order, and that includes ones that describe solid order also. And he speculated that this is due to vacancy condensation. So this idea of having vacancies in a super solid has recently been offered as a quote proof by Prokofiev and Shustinov, and that will be the case as long as you don't have a vacancy interstitial symmetry.
Can you explain what that means? There's no vacancy?
No, I mean, it's just that. Yeah. Okay. My understanding is that if you have phase coherence, you're going to have large scale density fluctuations. And that's what it means. But if you have exact symmetry, then you have as many vacancies as interstitial. Then
is a particle hole symmetry the same thing as a particle hole symmetry?
Well, yeah, except it's a boson. So you cannot have exact symmetry, but it can be good enough that. That more or less you have exactly the same number of vacancies as in interstitial. Okay, so you can sort of look at this idea in terms of a high TC like plot where you have filling on the vertical axis, and on this horizontal axis you look at the ratio between kinetic energy and potential energy. And then what happened is that, suppose on the average, you start out in a commensurate solid with one helium atom per side, then you can just continue increasing this kinetic energy along this axis, in which case you will go from a more insulated type solid to a commensurate super solid. But since the filling is not externally imposed but is self-adjusted by the system, it can take a different path. And so the idea of this vacancy mechanism is that as you come along this line, because there is no vacancy interstitial symmetry, it can deviate and then you just follow a different line. And then as soon as the delta, the filling becomes not equal to one, you have a incommensurate super solid. Okay. So this is a certainly a very interesting idea. However, experiment, and this is the Simmons data that we already seen before in this workshop, supposedly shows that the vacancy concentration is activated with an activation energy which is of the order of 10K, close to the melting pressure, but and then rises even becomes much higher to increase pressure. So this does not support the idea that at zero temperature you have a finite density of vacancy. So I should emphasize, of course, that this measurement is of course done in the normal solid. Okay, it's above the temperature where most of Kim and Chen saw the NCRI.
It's somehow up to believe that then there are two kinds of vacancies, right? There was this thermally activated kind and then there was some other kind.
No, just this will be answered in talk. But yeah, so this was not observed until the Kim and Chang experiment. And so just a repeat of what the previous graph said, and also from theoretical estimates, I guess, with calculation by David amongst other people, is that the strict limit on the vacancy density in normal solid, so that it extrapolates to zero, it should be either zero or extremely small, it extrapolates zero temperature. So you have an activation energy, let's say of 10 to 15 Kelvin, while if you look at interstitial, it's even much bigger. Naturally, since the helium atoms are very repulsive, maybe 50 Kelvin or so. So the quandary is, if we want the vacancy to be the mechanism of a supersolid, and if we take the TC as 0.2 Kelvin, then how can defects of such high activation energy condense at this kind of temperature? So our work is, we try to provide one resolution to this quandary, and by expanding the mechanism of vacancy condensation to include as a more type of defects. Okay, so here is the yeah.
Could there be vacancies and interstitials because of quantum fluctuation rather than if they bound,
then they don't do anything with respect to super solidity. Yeah, there are quantum fluctuations that we heard in David's talk and David Gallagher's talk yesterday. But the question is whether they're mobile or are they bound together. Okay, so so the proposed resolution is that this transition from the normal solid to super solid is in fact first order transition, so that at zero temperature, when you're in the normal solid phase, there are actually very little or no vacancy, while when you're in the super solid phase, you actually have a finite concentration, so it jumps. And because of this, so if you measure things in the normal state, you just don't see this vacancy concentration. Accompanying this first order transition is a vacuum switching, what we call vacuum switching, meaning that the vacancies actually do not condense on the background of the defect-free solid, but it condenses in the background and a type of defectron called excitons. Okay. The consequences of this is that, as in any vacancy mechanism, the normal solid, supersolid transition must be accompanied by a commensurate incommensurate transition. But this vacuum switching means that there is also a change in the local density profile of the helium atoms. Okay, so now let's just see how this can come about. First, let's give a simplified picture of the Andrea-Listed vacancy model. So we start with the perfect solid. So this is defect-free, which is sort of like a mod insulator of bosons, where you have one atom sitting on each side, and they are stuck in the potential well, and they couldn't tunnel elsewhere because of the repulsion of the other atoms. So in this vacancy model, we can look at one of these sides and consider removing this helium atom. And when you do that, actually there's some local distortion of the lattice around. So in the definition, that's all included already, this local distortion. Okay. So you start with this, having the atom in there, which is a defect-free, you remove its vacancy. Because we're interested in defects, so let me redefine things so that when you don't have any defects, I'll call that a vacuum. which is always shown in the white background. The original vacuum is shown in the green background in this talk. And then when you have a vacancy, it's actually like you have a particle there in this unit cell. Okay. So, and I'm showing it in blue. So you have this vacancy. Now, when you have this vacancy, you can look at locally what's the energy it takes to create such an energy, and let me call the epsilon A. So you have two levels here, the defect-free and then the vacancy. And of course, this vacancy can now tunnel from one site to its neighboring site, and we give it some tunneling amplitude called T subscript A. Then the net energy it takes to create such a vacancy would be the potential energy plus the kinetic energy. So it becomes just on-site activation epsilon A minus this kinetic energy you gain back, which is Z number of nearest neighbors times the tunneling amplitude TA. So if this energy turns out to be negative, then you can spontaneously create such vacancies. And once you create them, then you can condense them because the vacancy will also obey boson statistics as shown by Andrea and Lipschitz. So the vacancy will both condense, and then you have a mechanism to get the super solid. Unfortunately, what we have seen is that Simmons' experiment and other calculations have shown that this activation energy is actually not negative, it's positive, and in fact it's quite high. Okay, so it by itself is not going to work. Now, of course, you can also consider interstitial, and so what you have in this case is that in addition to the atom here, you add another helium atom into this unit cell, and of course this is quantum mechanical. So, yeah. So you should really not think of this atom as being in this site, but actually as some symmetric linear combination of all the symmetry-related sites. And in fact, these are not really just localized at a single position, but it's some kind of wave function that you should think about so that there's some spread and stuff. Again, after a redefinition of the vacuum, then the defect-free becomes the vacuum, and then this one is like having one defect here, out here. Again, you should think of them as being symmetrically linear combination. Right. But now, if you look at the tunneling of this, because this atom is displaced away from the center, if you want to make a tunnel, it has to tunnel a much smaller distance. Okay. And because of that, its tunneling amplitude is higher than that of the vacancy tunneling. So the interstitial should be able to tunnel easier. But the activation energy now, of course, is the on-site local creation energy of this interstitial, and then minus this kinetic energy that you can gain back. The kinetic energy is better for the interstitial, but the on-site creation energy is, of course, much larger because of the repulsion, strong repulsion between helium atoms.
I mean, why it's a shorter distance? Because the distance between the dual lattice and the square lattice is the same, right? The distance between
You see, because I don't have to hop from here to here. I only jump from here to here because this is a symmetric thing.
And where is the other atom? Because this little square was the binary size cell of your square lattice. So the interstitial will be at the corner of that square, and not in that position where you are going.
So if you strictly, if you take it in the corner, then I would take 1 over root 4 of this plus this plus this plus this, and then you would say the tunnel amplitude is actually 1/4. Or 1/2 actually, because two cells are in contact with each other.
There's a question about how many interstitial sites there are for each cell, right? But
I didn't realize this. Actually, I find this very appealing. I hadn't read it. I think the simplest way to think of what Mike and Fushin have done is that there's a 1A orbital, but there's a different band of 1A states. The 1A state at the next level would have these bumps around there. So basically, he's talking about the 1A states on each side on the next on the next level. How this next level tunnel? So the 1A state does have those features. Well, it may not be its fourth block, but it's all around the street.
Right. There's a subtlety of that because we know the ground state of helium has been known, so we cannot take the next 1A orbital, but it's some kind of thing that looks like this. So this way of thinking about the interstitial is a more quantum mechanical way than classical, where you just say you stick it right in the middle between the two atoms, because you actually don't do that. You take a symmetric combination of all the symmetry related directions so that those positions are nearest to this one and the nearest neighbor. So you can put them on the corners if you want. If you put in corners, the amplitude will be 1/2, but then you have a repulsion energy with the next atom too, which you don't necessarily want. So the way I imagine it, you move it a little bit inwards so that.
Can you move back to the full lattice when you see not only the linear size set, but the full lattice of red dots that you have?
Sure. Okay, so.
This is not a cut. I mean,
okay. So one thing is first, because nothing I say depends on XCP. I'm just drawing things easy, so I just put a square letter.
So that means if I have to put an interstitial there,
yeah,
I will put it more or less at the same distance of all the red dots, which will be outside.
Yeah. But square. What I'm saying is that you shouldn't put it here. You should take a linear combination of those four positions.
But the hoping, I mean, in the same way that you were taking a linear combination of vacancies at different positions, the hoping will be.
I don't know what taking vacancy is well defined. You should remove it from the center.
Yeah, an interstitial. Okay. You have to put it as far as possible.
No, excuse me, student. I think there is really a very simple and more systematic way to talk about what Mike said, but I think it would.
Okay, so just don't think of this as an interstitial. Put an atom in some other wave function in this cell, okay? But which is off-center from this, and because it's off-center, it can tunnel easier.
Okay,
so don't think about whether this is actually the exact interstitial, because I don't use it anyway. So
okay.
I will not use the interstitial at all.
But there's another thing that you didn't even mention, that when you put an interstitial in, the density goes up, and exchange frequencies depend exponentially on the density.
That's why he's bad when he chooses interstitial. Basically, he's a one-way state.
I only put in one. I mean, this is all for single. So yeah. I mean, this.
So the density is identical. Even if you put it over there.
Okay. Okay, so let me just move on. So, but anyway, the idea is you can do this, but it doesn't help you because the repulsion energy is so strong that the net excitation energy is even higher than that for vacancy. But so, our model is to try to do the best of both worlds. We want to use the low activation energy of the vacancy and use the high tunneling amplitude of the quote interstitial. Okay, so this is the have your cake and eat it two model. So what we do is we introduce a third type of defect, which is a bond vacancy interstitial in the same unit cell. Again, if you don't like thinking of that as the true interstitial, it's just a thing where you first add an atom in this next different state and then remove the one in the middle. Okay. So what happened then is you have this state which we call the exciton, but in terms of the original helium atom picture, all you do is just displace your helium atom from the center position to a position off-center. Okay, again, you should take this as linear combination and also think of them more like wave functions. So it's a wave function which is less localized and off-center from where the original position is. Okay, so we'll call this exciton just because you can think of them two bands and then just like exciton the electronic system, and in that language it is more like a Frankel exciton. Okay, so now let's look at the energy level of the system on a single site. So what you have is the defect free, and then you have the exciton, the vacancy, and the system. The thing is that the exciton should have a lower energy than either the vacancy or the interstitial, because you do not put two atoms in the same unit cell, so you don't have that large repulsion energy. Also, you're just moving it from the best state to something different, so it's not as bad as just completely yanking that atom out and creating a vacancy. Okay, so you have a relatively low-lying defect, which again we call this exciton.
So they're in the same unit cell, these things. Is that what you're saying?
This
is the same.
And
how would even be sensed? How would you even tell that this was there? Because we see those fluctuations all the time.
Okay, no, this is a static. The thing is not fluctuating, it's a static displacement. Okay, so it's a static displacement away.
Okay.
So So let me just continue on. What you're going to do is, then we claim that you should measure, and between this normal solid and a super solid, you would see a different local density profile, static density profile.
Like a symmetry break, it would break the HCP symmetry.
So no, it would not break the HCP, because this is in the symmetry related direction.
For, I think that if there are questions about whether the state comes from and whether it's a collaborative symmetry, I claim that there is such a state. In fact, that I think it's a very natural way to do the state. We can discuss it later, but
if you want to imagine what you do, you take the potential well and you look at the next higher, next excited state, not the ground state potential well, but remove the nodes. Just remove the nodes. Smooth out the nodes of that. So you don't have.
Oh, you don't even have to smooth out the nodes.
No.
All you need to have is another state up there. So.
No, but it's the ground state of helium has been nodeless. So, but that's not a primary consideration because that energy effect is small. But I just don't want someone to say, how can you write down the ground state we have nodes?
Okay, it seems David said this breaks the lattice symmetry if it's a static.
I don't break any lattice symmetry. Let me just show you, okay? So because this is symmetrically oriented along the symmetry directions of the system, it's a linear combination symmetrically along all the symmetry related directions. I try to be very careful about that. Anyway, so the key physics is that the vacancies can both condense easier over this exciton background because it has now a higher tunneling amplitude than over the defect-free background, which has a lower amplitude. The activation energy is smaller because to activate from this exciton into the vacancy, you only have to take epsilon A minus delta. You don't have to go all the way from epsilon A. So if you have this background, then it's much easier for vacancy to condense, and the stability criteria is now epsilon A minus delta minus Z times TB, that's large tunneling amplitude. Now, of course, you still have to overcome the energy it takes to create this exciton. But if your condensation amplitude is sufficiently large, then that condensation energy can be greater than this delta, and the vacancies can both condense. But just from this, you can see that it must be a first order transition, because if you only take one, not going to do it. You need a finite concentration in order for that condensation energy to overcome the exciton activation energy delta.
What is delta?
Okay.
How much is delta?
Okay. So epsilon A is, let's say, 15 Kelvin, right. 10 to 15 Kelvin. And so this delta we take to be smaller. In the actual calculation I'm going to show you, is taken to be about 0.2 of epsilon A, but that's not important in terms of what possibility you can get. Okay, matching our parameters to actual experimental value is not something we can do at this point. We can only look at reasonable values and see what happens. Okay,
How can you distinguish between the exciton and the zero point?
It's static, because it's static distortion. It's not a fluctuation, it's not a phonon, no wave vibrates to and fro, it's not zero-point motion, it's a static distortion.
It's static.
Let me just show you. Okay.
If it's static, that makes lattice symmetry.
No, but he's doing the sum of all this.
I already answered that question, so I'm not going to answer that question about breaking lattice symmetry another time, okay? Okay, so what the idea is that you have a normal solid which has no defect, or basically...
Everything he says is correct.
Or basically no defect, which is stable against the creation of any type of defects. However, there is also an unstable solid, which is defect-free, where everything is exciton. And you still don't have vacancy. But now, if I have this, I can, as unstable with respect to the spontaneous creation of vacancy, and you can do that, and you will have a system where you have both exciton and vacancy defects. And however, once you do this, it may be that this state can have a lower energy than this state.
Could I ask this question once again?
Yeah.
If we looked at the density, would we see not a peak in the middle, but four peaks on the corners?
Right. So I would get into that right
and
away.
That's a measurable, and it's been done by Simmons, and he sees a nice peak in the middle, right?
Okay. But that's in the normal solid, right?
That's in the normal.
Okay, so that's right. So that's a very strong.
That's a measurable.
That's a very strong. Yeah, I'm right.
Well, Mike, all you're saying that there are okay. fluctuations.
Can you just wait for my next slide, and I would say this. Okay, so the zero temperature transition is going to be first order, and the normal supersolar transition has to be accompanied by two things: the commensurate and incommensurate transition, because you have vacancy, and also because you're going from this to the exciton background, it has to be accompanied by a change in local density profile. So what exactly is this local density profile? Okay, so here, let me take a scan from this edge of the unit cell to that edge. So in the normal solid, you would expect that you just have a simple Gaussian, which is peak in the center. Now, if you take this idea of the exciton completely seriously, then yes, you're going to have four symmetric peaks, or in the case of XCP, 12 symmetric peaks, whatever. And the middle may still be some small peak, or it could even become a minimum. Now, on the other hand, in the continuum of distortion that you can get starting from middle to this, you can think of other type of distortion that you can. Remember, this is static distortion, though. You measure the static density profile, okay? It's not fluctuations. It could be also could just be a distortion of the shape of this so that it becomes something broader, and that's possible. Broader is okay. Right.
I agree.
You can also just make it broader. It's just this case of what's best. But you can go even to this extreme, and it could still be good. Okay. So, but the big thing is that there has to be a change in the local density profile.
Yeah, I agree.
Right. Okay. There is a change, but I think actually what happened, even if you put the four peaks of the wave function in the corners of the square.
Yeah.
The tails can end up with quite substantial peak remaining in the center.
Oh yeah. So that's why you could still have a residual maximum in the middle.
What I'm saying is it could be the other way. It could be big peak at the center, still it could be.
Okay, then there'll be some sub peaks. Right. So I cannot make a precise prediction about what exactly the local density profile. Of course, if it has side peaks, that would be fantastic. Okay, but if it doesn't have side peak, if there's a substantial broadening, I think that would still be. In agreement with what we are proposing.
So given a local density profile, can you plug it into your model and actually say whether it's sufficient to the mix vertex? Suppose someone hands you a local density profile and says, here it is.
Yeah. I have to compare. What I want to do is compare the normal solid density profile and the solid.
Because it changes a little. Can you plug it into your model and the escape?
Are you willing to talk about numbers?
Am I willing to talk about numbers? Well, if I have a way to match the other parameters, yes. I mean, but I have a first order transition. I mean, it's drastic. It should not be just some small change. So if there's a way to measure the local density profile experimentally, and you do it in the solid,
sure.
Super solid state, and the...
Well, you look at the bi-wall factor.
The measurement will begin on April 14th.
Okay, right. So...
What about the total density?
The total density, it depends on your setup. In the cell experiment, I assume total density is fixed. That's why there's a commensurate incommensurate transition when you introduce vacancies. Okay. Yeah.
So basically, you're not allowing any additional vacancies to be created as you enter into super state.
Yes. Yes. They have to be debated. The whole idea is that the transition.
That means the lattice constant has to change.
The lattice constant has to change. That's right. And that's why it changed from commensurate to incommensurate.
Fixed
in
fixed
B,
so the lattice constant
will
have to change.
The
density is fixed.
What
happens to pressure?
Well, right. So actually, I don't understand, because sometimes Moses said it's constant density. I'm assuming constant density.
Pressure very carefully.
We can measure the pressure.
Yeah, but a good guy did this right along the melting, they didn't see anything, right?
Well, his heat B or the second band hopping would decrease. At first sight, it looks like as if they would increase, but actually they would decrease because.
With pressure? Yeah. So yeah. I will come back and address those questions. So I should also mention that yesterday we heard about how the vacancy mass is actually smaller than the helium mass. Now, I cannot understand that. I don't understand that. But it could be that the vacancy mass can be substantially reduced from. TA into this TB by this type of mechanism?
Well, it certainly is.
There is no theory, right?
So, no, I mean, so there is an experimental measurement of vacancy mass in the normal solid, which says it's about 5 times helium mass. Yesterday we heard it's 0.31 of helium mass. I don't know how that's possible, but I'm saying that there could be a reduction due to this type of effect.
Theory, right?
Huh?
Theory,
it's just from the shadow shadow wave function calculation. Okay. Okay. For those of us who like microscopic wave function, then you can also write down all this wave function. You should mentally put in a gestural factor in that. Okay, I just don't want to keep typing gestural factor. So the idea is a normal solid, you take a vacuum and then you have a lattice, and on every side you create a boson, and this boson created in a localized state which is centered on the lattice side. And this describes something which is commensurate, and the phi should have a single peak structure. When you go to super solid, you have to have vacancies. So Jason already wrote down this wave function the other day. You have U plus V times some A dagger, which is a boson creation operator. And now the product over number of sites, the number of sites is greater than the number of particles. So that this U square, epsilon magnitude, is a vacancy fraction, tells you what fraction you have. But now that there's another difference, is that you no longer create those B bosons. You're going to create some A bosons, so that they create a helium atom in a localized state, which is different from the phi. What I can say is that for sure, I want this chi to be more delocalized than the phi, less localized than the phi. But in the best scenario, that should, they might even have multi-peak. Okay. I just want to make a quick statement that that while if you're in the commensurate situation, then there's a difference between the gestural notional wave function and the usual gestural wave function. Once you create vacancies, there's actually no fundamental difference between the two different types of wave functions. As you can see, you can take this, and just like what Jason said, you project in a state with definite number of particles. You apply the so-called Gauss-Wheeler projection to stop creating two bosons of the same on the same site, and then you rewrite it in first quantized form, and you see what you have is just a product wave function of a single extended wave function, which is periodic with the periodicity of crystal, and then with a gestural factor in front, of course. Okay, so there's no question, since we know that this wave function has off-diagonal long-range order, there's no question, no matter which type of wave function you write, once you have vacancy, you're going to have off-diagonal long-range order.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So the order of probability actually is the quantum average of A particle is not zero, right? On this wave function, it's not a B particle. So the A particle supposed to use all the
well, next particle. A and B are just helium atom.
Yeah, but I mean,
they just create things different. So the true order parameter, you should always think about actually this side dagger of R. That's the true order parameter.
I'm saying if you decompose to different orbital states,
yeah.
B is in the lowest, A is the left one. Suppose it's nodeless.
Okay, yeah.
That's the picture.
Yeah.
You promote the one particle from the lowest state to higher in on each lattice.
Yeah.
So A is in the next band. So
yeah.
Basically, in this wave function, is the if you average, so you're talking about the vacancy and condensate. I would think about it as the condensate of A, this is in the next orbital state.
Yeah, but again, as I answered, I really don't want it to be a one-year wave function on the next excited state, because then that's a question of nodes. It's really just a distortion of the original wave function, which mimics somewhat the next excited state.
That doesn't cause you any problem.
Okay.
We have nodes wouldn't cause you any problem. All you need is another
state,
then
fine. Yeah, but you see, there's no real physics contained in that, because it's still condensation of the same helium atom.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
So that's the main thing. I don't want to think that as if there's a different superfluid because you're
the physics, however, is allowing you to have a fluctuations into a different state that creates
okay.
motion.
Okay. Right. And this is something different from other systems where things are externally imposed, because it can do this. Because itself adjusts itself to whatever is the best scenario. Okay, so the way we tackle this problem, the Hamiltonian is written in the paper. I don't want to show the Hamiltonian, so that's this effective Hamiltonian describing those defects. But the idea is that we use a single site mean field theory for zero temperature, and we solve it self-consistently. In addition to the mean field energy, actually the total energy of system, we have to also include the elastic energy due to the fact that when you introduce a vacancy, you have to change the lattice constant, and there's an elastic energy cost in that. So we include that term into this and calculate total energy and then figure out what's the best solution. Okay, so it's a crude mean field theory, but the justification is that the main, most important thing we think we need to include is a strong on-site correlation between heat and momentum, and that's taken into account. It has been shown to be successful for other lattice type models. If you look at the instability criteria for the Andrei lattice model, it gives you the exact instability criteria. And our result is actually strengthened in terms of the stability of this supersolid phase by including quantum fluctuations. Okay. So we believe the result is not an artifact of mean field theory. Okay, so here's a phase diagram. Okay, this phase diagram is plotted on the horizontal axis. Is the vacancy tunneling amplitude in the normal background. Here is the vacancy tunneling amplitude of the exciton background. Okay. And these are measured in units of the units of this local vacancy activation energy epsilon A. We take epsilon B to be 4 times epsilon A, and the delta 0.2 epsilon A. So if I take epsilon A to be 15 Kelvin, then delta is going to be 0.2. well, it'll be 3 point. It'll be 3 Kelvin, sorry. Okay, so that's the kind of energy scale we want to say. But our most important point is this: here, in this dashed line, this dashed line is the instability criteria of Andrei and Lipschitz. This dashed line is the instability criteria if you want to consider interstitial instability. Okay, now, so anything in this inside the region bounded by two deadlines are things that you cannot get supersolid with if you only consider either vacancies only or interstitials only. And what we have is that you can see that there are regions now in this parameter diagram where you can have supersolid by including the effect of the exciton, while you would not be able to do so if you did not include the effect of the exciton. Now, along here, if you go past this F9, then here you just get the Andrei vacancy supersolid. However, as I said, this is not supported by experiment. Experiment does not support that you can do this. But instead, we now have a region which is not outside the realm of the limit given by the experiment, where you can, in fact, still get a supersolid, which is mostly formed from vacancies condensing above a background of this of the excitons. Okay. So that's the zero temperature phase diagram. Now, of course, we really would need to be able to match this to experimental parameters like the pressure. Okay.
This is how would you do that? Yeah.
Okay. So you see, all this local excitation energy is going to increase with pressure. The problem is that the tunneling amplitude has two effects. When you put things closer, of course, it tunnels a shorter distance. However, the wave function also narrow when you do that. So what we think is that if you go to high enough pressure, there's no question that the effect would be those are increasing and those are decreasing. So you are going somewhere, you know, you're following some curve going this way if you go to high enough pressure. But if you are not at very high pressure, there could be some non-monotonic behavior where those tunneling amplitudes can actually increase by increasing pressure. So we need a better handle on this. And if there are better if there are more points in the experiment or if we understand the experiments better, we might be able to do that. I almost killed myself there, but I hope I caught myself in time. Okay, so So that's what we hope one can do. Okay, now what about finite temperature? Actually, we don't have the full calculation, because in finite temperature, we, in order to especially discuss the low temperature behavior, we need to be able to handle the correlations between different sites better, like, because the phase mode is something which is gapless, whereas the mean field has a gap. Okay, so we are in the middle of doing that calculation. But I'll just illustrate to you what kind of effect you can get by looking at the case where epsilon b, so the interstitial, has infinite energy, so we don't consider it. And then the tunneling is only possible if you are tunneling over the exciton background. And then we take the exciton excitation energy to be equal to the vacancy energy. So you see, I don't actually have to tune this exciton energy that well. You know, it's not the fact that I make it so small. It's just changing quantitatively, but the central result that I said it remains true. So what happened here is that now I have the defect-free state, and then I have this doublet of the exciton and the vacancy. So I can label this n equals 0, meaning there's no defect, and n equals 1, meaning there's some defect. And if there's a defect, then there's a doublet, which is like a spin one-half system. And actually, that's the model, the Hamiltonian, then sort of a spin one-half XY model, but with vacancy that you can have. The vacancy on the XY model, not the true helium vacancy. It's actually the defect-free state, which plays the role of frequency. Vacancy in that state. The thing is that there are two coupled all the parameters in here. One is the defect concentration, the other is the condensate amplitude. And they're coupled to each other and they interplay with each other. And then you end up getting a phase diagram that should sort of look like this. So here's the zero temperature thing, and here's the critical point where on this side you have the normal solid, which is defect free, and here you have the super solid, which is defect rich. And again, if I want to just look at it in terms of pressure, I have a little bit of problem until I get high pressure where things change monotonically. But if I'm right at this point, this two states have the same energy. Now what happens as you go to finite temperature? See, this one is an activation from the defect-free state to those higher states. So the free energy changes exponentially. While this one is a you have a super solid, so you have both condensation, so you have the phase mode. So you have a T to the 4 correction to this. So this one, the free energy lowers by some power of the temperature. This one only lowers exponentially. And so this one, this state here, in principle, should always win. However, there's a caveat to that, because I also need to include into this consideration the lattice elastic free energy, and looking at their temperature correction, which is of course also T to 4. And I don't know which state has a better T to the 4 free energy correction. So depending on which scenario, you can either have this situation going on where you have this funny re-entrant situation where the zero temperature state is actually not a super solid, but then as you increase the temperature, it can become a super solid. So it's sort of like thermally activated, but in a more convoluted way. So if I'm bold, I may try to ask if this is the transition that Professor Goodkind seemed to see. But since I don't have a way of figuring out what pressure any of this corresponds to, I'll just be conservative and just say that there seems maybe something interesting. Or the other situation that you can have, of course, is that in fact it gets destroyed, the super solid gets destroyed at this zero temperature point when you raise to finite temperature, and then you have some curve like this. And this is the first order transition here, so in general you expect then this first order behavior to remain up to some tricritical point beyond which is second order. In order to address the experiment, it seems natural to think that the experiment is in this regime where I have the first order transition, so that the defect I see out here is something which is very small, and then when I cross the transition, the first order effect gives me a loss of defects. Yeah.
Well, I mean, if you've got a first order transition, shouldn't you see a gigantic change in the specific heat? Or
well, you have latent heat.
Well, yeah,
so, but what experiment I would say experiment we're seeing is a smear first order transition. So I don't know actually what one should see. So the specific heat is a puzzle for everyone concerned, not just me at this point, I think.
For both transitions, it is not for surface things.
Okay.
But in the incommensurate phase, would you also predict that would you not be a pure T cube in low temperature?
No, the specific should be T cube. I mean, there'll be higher corrections, like this T7. But this T7 actually can be explained
in
many ways, not just the Henderson-Brinkman-Hills way.
What about these very careful thermodynamic studies along the melting line? Wouldn't you see that point where that intersects?
Well, the melting line is somewhere out here, so how would I know what? The melting line is somewhere out here, right? This is all purely the super solid, normal solid transition.
They go along the sample, which has a crystal and a liquid coexisting, can go down to low temperatures and look for some, since you expect the liquid be, say, a nice superfluid with a nice thermodynamic properties, if there's something happening in the solid on the other side, there should be a kink.
It hasn't been done, David.
I thought that's what you did, right?
The melting curve? No, that was in solid.
That was in solid. But yeah. You should still see something when you cross
the... There should be a kink in the melting curve, yeah.
Yeah.
I would look for that.
Going back to the very beginning, why do you always have a first order transition again? Why can't you have a second order transition?
Oh, okay, the first order transition comes off the calculation, but the idea is because the stability of vacancy about the normal, the defect-free background is stable. Okay, that is given by the experiment, the fact that you have finite activation energy. The instability is actually with respect to the exciton background. But once it's unstable, it can condense, and that condensation energy can overcome the exciton activation energy. So that's why it has to be first order transition, because to condense, you need a finite concentration.
And it's triggered by what? By density? By temperature?
No. So on this axis, it's triggered by model parameters. The ratio of kinetic energy to potential energy is how it's triggered. So somehow the pressure is changing the ratio of kinetic energy by potential energy. So once you have that, then when you increase the temperature, then of course the entropy effect comes in and do something. And that gives rise to a transition. Okay. Now note that this. Oh, did somebody else have a question? Or?
Yeah.
Okay. I think he has a question.
I was going to say, if there's a quench density profile difference, right? Why couldn't you tell it from something like the structure factor?
Okay. So I think if you do form factor X-ray, I think you see it. I just don't know if this is done. As far as I know, there is no measurement in the super solid phase of even the incommensurability. So as far as I know, there's also no measurement of the local density profile. Again, that's why this first order is very important. The whole idea of first order is you don't see anything if you're in the normal solid. Okay? It's only if you're in the super solid. Now, of course, so right now it means that I'm ducking behind a barrier and just say, well, you don't have the result. And if you make a measurement, it's not there, then this theory is gone, as far as I'm concerned. Okay.
Are you finished, or
do
you have any more slides?
I do have
a little bit more. Just
quick. Okay, so I'll just finish in
a couple. Try to finish
okay, so can I just finish, and then if people have questions, or we can talk privately. So the thing, though, is that what I'm showing you here is the transition in defect concentration. The condensate amplitude itself actually can behave both ways. So as you go up the temperature, the defect concentration goes down, and then it makes a first order jump somewhere. Now you can look at the condensate amplitude, and it can go to zero below this defect transition. Okay, in this case, then the condensate, the both condensed transitions should be a second order transition, and there will be two transitions, one for the defect and one for the condensate.
Yeah, but you can see.
Huh? And it's a defect. It's both the vacancy and the exciton. Okay, it's either defect. What the ratio of the two would depend on what the parameter is in the system. In the case where I'm taking them to be degenerate, it's 50-50, but it does not have to be that way. But on the other hand, it could be that by the time this transition occurs, the both condensed amplitude is still non-zero, in which case, when this goes down, this just stops being a super solid, and so then the transition can be first order. So I'm thinking that probably this is the situation that is seen experimentally. So let me just quickly look at a casual comparison with the experiments. So our value calculated value of rho s is not so great. It's pretty high compared to the maximum experimental value. But since there's a lot of uncertainty in the parameters, and also we did not include the zero temperature, the quantum phase fluctuations, that could drive it down. So what about the pressure dependence? And we already answered that. So it could be that this is due to a non-monotonic behavior of the tunneling amplitude with respect to pressure. We hope, though, that eventually this is supposed to take a first order jump. If you go to high enough, pressure. Okay, that's what we hope. This data already, Alan Dorsey talked about that, seems to be some smear transition. So Jason has a different interpretation. So if this is smeared by disorder, there are two possibilities. One is that the pure system is not in the universality class of XY, because XY is stable against most type of disorder, although there could be long-range disorder which we can change its universality class. Or it could be a first-order transition, which I'm proposing, in which case the disorder can smear that. Then finally, as far as helium-3 impurities, you put helium-3 has a smaller mass, so it's easier to create a vacancy, because by creating a vacancy, the helium can move easier. And that will give rise to an increase in TC, because the more vacancies, the higher the transition temperature. But at the same time, these are impurities, and so there's localization physics, where you can localize the bosons, in this case the vacancies, and by that reduce rho s, and maybe even eventually destroy the boson condensation. This is the physics of dirty bosons, which some of us have been involved in also.
Would that be proportional to the concentration?
No, but the trouble is, we already found PPM, so I don't, you know, locally it's a Taylor expansion, of course, so I cannot say anything. Now, if you ask me why, how can PPM have any effect like this, then I cannot say. Now, on the other hand, if you could say, though, that it may be whatever he's measuring is already quite close to this both gas super solid transition, and so a small change can destroy the super. So
that's delicate tuning, which is.
Right, I mean, but on the other hand, you know, there are not many points along the helium concentration curve. You have PPM, and then you have PPB.
Well, I think the PPB, the concentration side, there is quite a bit of points, and the rho s and TC increases, right?
Yeah, but okay, so first, according to Moses, rho s actually becomes zero after some part. So that is not observable beyond 0.1%.
He's saying that TC may be low.
Huh?
No.
At the low temperature rho s disappear. High helium concentration. I don't want to say anything about PPB. Okay. So whatever theory you have, you need to have a way to explain why it's destroyed, right? Why the superfluid density is actually killed zero. The Bose glass superfluid transition is one of the simplest explanation for that. I mean, there could be other explanations. I'm not saying that any of this is support for our theory. I'm saying that our theory at a casual glance is not totally in contradiction with the experiments. There, of course, can be many other explanations, as we've heard during the course of this week and next week. Okay, I think that's all I want to say. So thank you very much.
Mike, if you set U to zero, namely there's no vacancy amplitude in the ground state for the supersolid.
What is equal to zero?
U.
U,
U plus V, right?
Oh yeah, yeah, in the wave function, yeah.
If we set U equal to zero, any conclusion of yours would change or not?
Oh, I believe that the gestural notional wave function has no off-diagonal range order. There's a paper by Xu et al., which I don't think the proof is correct. But on the other hand, I believe the result is correct, which is that wave function does not, just by permuting localized wave function, I do not think you can get off-diagonal range order. That's why I also was wondering about the cooperative ring exchange. But.
I guess my question is more to maybe measurements.
Uh-huh.
But if this is some kind of a first order, like you say it's smear, but should there be some sort of supercooling or
Ah, okay, yeah, that's a good question. I really have not thought about what the consequences of the smear first order transition is. So, and there are two order parameters happening in the first order transition. So,
I mean, just the basic picture I find really difficult to accept that because the Debye frequency, this is helium, solid helium is like a particle in a box, and the kinetic energy is, we know, is 30 Kelvin, right? So any kind of distortion away from that, you have to look at what the excited state is, and it's going to be on the order of 30 Kelvin. And what are you going to gain by distorting the wave function? It's only going to be the delocalization, which is like two orders of magnitude smaller. You can never you would never be able to compensate, I would think. That distort the wave function, you're going to just pick up this tiny bit of energy, but it's going to cost you on the order of 30 Kelvin to do that.
Well, okay, so you're saying if I take a high momentum phonon frequency, then let's say that's of the order of 30 Kelvin, or what? Okay, right. But if I take this static distortion, I don't necessarily, I mean, it depends on how I distort the shape of the wave function. But so with the energy scale we put in, so you may say with the one I show you, that it is 3 Kelvin, so maybe that's 10 times too small. But as I said, I can actually set that equal to the vacancy energy, and you know, there will be a region where this will come out also, and then I'm putting it at 15 Kelvin now. Now, so that ZTB there, you see, in that boundary, is on the order of 2. So I am assuming that the tunneling amplitude is of the order of 20 Kelvin or so, that you can go increase. But on the other hand, the original vacancy tunneling, I can take to be as small as possible. Yeah, so those are definitely very legitimate questions.
Anyway, the other side is that this is the kind of fluctuation we should see in our simulation. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Brian did, after we talked a few months ago, yep. Brian did a calculation. I mean, he calculated energy versus concentration, and you know, we just see a vacancies, and we don't see any kind of a change in the curve. It just goes up. The more vacancies you put in, the higher the energy is.
Okay, so what concentration have you done up to?
From like 1 to 5%, I guess, right?
Yeah.
So from 0.5%,
up to what?
Where it melts, which is about 5%.
So if you put it at 5%, then there's so many vacancies.
Okay, so but you're governed by the density then, right? Because of the size of the cell, number of particles. So when you're 5%, the density is small enough. Low enough that it melts.
Intensity,
sorry, temperature,
constant.
Within the theory, across the transition, 10% vacancy is not unreasonable. In our theory, actually, it could even be more. Of course.
That's for the exciton.
No. So again, it has to be done in the supersolid phase.
Not necessarily. No. You said in a couple of diagrams, right? There was another one where basically it condenses after the exciton is formed.
Yeah, but I don't think experimentally that is the situation. So if it is, yeah, then this is possible. Now, so within our general parameter space, all kinds of things are possible. So helium corresponds to one particular set of values. So it may or may not, right? So we would of course also like to extend this to other systems where we can maybe use other part of the phase diagram.
Okay. Thank you. So, what's the sense of people?